shout. Let's all talk about the perk rule. We can rule it out, PE. I'm talking about you. Come on. Shout, shout, perk rule them out.
Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is May 16th, 2018, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Shout, Shout, Perk Rule Them Out.
Seriously?
Now you know what the theme music's going to be. All right, and I have Dr. Jeff Klein. Jeff is the Vice Chair in Research in Emergency Medicine and a Professor of Physiology, Indiana University School of Medicine. He's the Editor-in-Chief of AEM, creator of the PERC rule, the Pulmonary Embolism Rule-Out Criteria, and has published extensively in the area of pulmonary emboli. Welcome to the SGEM, Jeff.
Thanks, Ken. It's great to be here in beautiful Indianapolis at SAM 18.
And the audio, if people are listening to this while they're out for a run or in their car, they will realize that this is a live show. So we have an audience, and I'd like to have some audience participation here. So hello, audience.
Hello.
And like you said, we're at the SAM annual scientific meeting in Indianapolis. And I'm going to ask you what you think is so great about Indy, because you're from here. But I have to tell you, yesterday, I went out to the Speedway. Oh, yes. And I didn't meet Ricky, but I met Bobby. And I met Bobby, Uncle Bobby, as he's referred to, as Uncle Bobby Unser. Is that Unser? And he was so nice, and we got our picture taken with him, and I had my Batman mask on. It was an epic day, and we watched the first day of them practicing on the Speedway for the Indy 500. So cool. If you ever get a chance, come down to Indy and check it out. But what else can we do here in Indy?
The best thing you can do is be here during the summer, because the summers are just absolutely gorgeous, and we live through the winter. But you don't know much about winter, do you?
He's telling me they live through the winter, and I'm from Canada, eh? I mean, doesn't it say hoser right there instead of Hoosier? I'm the hoser, so yeah, no, I understand. We have two seasons, yeah, August and winter. All right, so we like to start each of the podcasts with a case. So we have a case to lead it off, and Jeff is going to give the case scenario for this talk on pulmonary embolism.
This is a 47-year-old woman that presents to the emergency department with a 24-hour history of chest pain and shortness of breath. She has a past medical history of hypothyroidism and gastroesophageal reflux disease, and she's on levothyroxine and proton pump inhibitor.
You sound so enthusiastic.
Vital
like,
signs.
Another case of a PE.
Not so sure about that. Vital signs are normal, heart rate is 72, blood pressure 130 over 80, respiratory rate 12. Must be dead. pulse ox of 97% and normal temp. Physical exam doesn't indicate any cause of the complaint. EKG, chest x-ray, and routine lab work is normal, included troponin. You risk stratify her by Gestalt, and Wells criteria is not high. And wondering if you can use the PERC rule to rule her out and not order the dreaded D-dimer.
Now, did you notice that he skipped over? I've got the notes here, right? He skipped over the temperature because I put it in Celsius.
We use Celsius.
Burn! Do you use Celsius down here?
Yeah, we use Celsius.
Centigrade?
We use
All right, so here's the background information. Pulmonary embolism rule-out criteria, or PERC, is an 8-item clinical decision instrument. I don't like to use rules because rules are meant to be broken. And this 8 items include the following, and since I've got Jeff here, can you tell us what why couldn't you have 5? I could remember 5. I need an app for 8. So why don't you tell us what are the 8 items on the PERC rule?
Well, I want to give the single most important thing I have to say, and that is don't memorize rules. Use your brain for something else that's more important. Heck, I can't even remember my own rule. So you need to look it up. Use MDCalc, use some tool to help you. Don't and this is not like how many push-ups you can do or how long you can hold your breath, and I can memorize all of the components of the Canadian head CT, neck, chest, knee
elbow,
roll.
Knee, head and shoulders, knees and toes,
yeah,
knees and toes,
E
and steel.
Just look it up. So that's what I'm doing. So you flunk the PERC rule for any of the following. Age over 50. Sorry, I flunk it.
Tomorrow I flunk it.
It's tomorrow, right?
Tomorrow I flunked that rule.
Yeah. Well, thank you. We're still PERC negative today. Heart rate greater than 100.
Yeah,
SATs
good.
Less than 95%. Any prior history of venous thromboembolism, recent trauma or surgery. And to find that is anything less than 4 weeks, endotracheal anesthesia or epidural anesthesia. Hemoptysis, any exogenous estrogen use, and that's either taking it by pill or transdermal or NuvaRing, but not depot Provera. And unilateral leg swelling, which was defined as you put your hands underneath the patient's heels, lift the heels up, look at the calves, ask yourself, do they look symmetric? If your answer is no, they have unilateral leg swelling.
There we go, the PERC rule from the guy who invented the PERC rule. And because I have you here, rather than the usual background information, other than just describing the PERC rule, I wanted to take the opportunity to ask 5 questions about pulmonary emboli. And then at the end of this podcast, I'm going to ask the audience if you have any questions, since we have them here. So I'm going to run through those five questions. The first of the 5 questions is, what's the history of the PERC rule? Like, how did it come about? Why 8 items instead of 5? And when did you publish the first PERC paper?
I think the history of the PERC rule really just goes back to my residency when I would fight with my attendings who wanted me to order VQ scans. That's all what we had in the 90s, and VQ scans took 3 to 4 hours to get done, and I kept never thinking these people needed the VQ scans done, and my attendings always thought they did. So I got interested in pulmonary embolism and wanted to first try to rule it out using something called capnography, just the exhaled CO2. And from there, I realized, you know, that's really a little bit too tough to do. So started working on criteria in the late 90s and ultimately came up with the rule in 2003. Now, why 8 instead of 5?
Why 8? I mean, I need both hands.
Well, because I know that you can't remember more than 5 things, and I just want to make you order a test up there in Canada so that finally we can get some parity in our test ordering.
But, you know, every time an American makes fun of me, I just go to the hospital and get my feelings checked for free. So question number 2. Oh, burn. The controversy of its use in Europe. Like, why are the Europeans so sort of, they don't really seem to like the PERC rule?
Well, they don't because they didn't invent it. The other thing is that they believe that it can't exclude the high-risk patients that get referred to emergency departments in France, the Netherlands, and maybe less so in Italy. Now, it used to be even Canada had prevalences of pulmonary embolism among patients tested. It was around 20%. But like McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken, we've exported over-testing to Canada. So you guys are down around 10%. And the same thing is happening in Europe, where they used to have up to a 30% prevalence. That means 3 out of 10 people that were tested for PE had PE in emergency departments in France. By the way, if you've ever been to one of these, any hospital, metropolitan, you know, say Paris, the average age of the patient in the emergency department is like 80 years old. I mean, they are much older. And if you look at any of the ages of patients who are in, whether they're treatment or diagnostic studies done in Europe, they're always older than they are in the United States. Well, recently we've seen that 30% number creeping down because I think we're exporting over-testing to Europe as well. And so the big question was, could we come in with the components of the PERC rule, which include gestalt, low risk, plus the 8 objective criteria, and will it work in that high prevalence population?
I love how he just segued there, because my question number 3 is about clinical gestalt. And I was going to ask you about what the value or role or power of clinical gestalt is in working up people with suspected pulmonary embolism. And how does that compare to someone who's risk stratifying using something like the Wells criteria?
Well, let's do a bit of history,
okay,
shall we?
Yep.
Gestalt is a German word.
Gestalt.
Which means that you take all of the parts and put them together to make a conclusion. And no single piece of the part can make sense because the human brain can aggregate to come to a conclusion. If you like German words, there's a better word that I think we
should
talk about.
Please, share it with the audience.
It's Fingerspitzengefühl. Fingerspitzengefühl means to the touch of the finger, but it means the finger of your mind, your ability to actually see and feel the patient. And the way you do Gestalt is you just make sure you have your own attention, have you asked the right questions, done a history and physical, and then say, do I think there's less than a 15% chance that this patient has pulmonary embolism, period. You do that, you line it up, you're going to be right. You're going to be really right. Even if you live in France and you say that, 97% of the time, that patient is not going to have a pulmonary embolism. In the United States, it's 98% of the time, just by using the brain that God gave you.
All right. So question number four, the inference about subsegmental PE and the possible overdiagnosis.
Wow, that's a big one, and it requires a clinical trial. Now, we just have a meta-analysis coming out looking at those studies that reported treatment versus not treatment of isolated subsegmental PE. This is, of course, PE without deep venous thrombosis. And it looks like the outcomes, based on non-randomized trials, is equally good without treatment as with treatment. In fact, there's a little bit more complications with treatment of subsegmental PE. You know what it is? We don't want to find it, because if you find it, you don't know what to do with it.
Now what are you going to do, right? If you don't ask, you don't have to deal with it, right?
I've got to call my friendly hospitalist to admit the patient.
Well, that's because you admit everybody. And I don't mean you. I mean, who do you admit with pulmonary embolism or DVT in the U.S. is well over 90%, and in Canada, it's about 50%. We send about 50% of our DVTs and PEs home.
And for the audience, everyone knows Ken is a part-time hospitalist.
Yes. All right, so
I call him sometimes from India.
And bounce the hospitalist stuff off me. So question number five, and then we'll get into the critical appraisal part. Question number five is how to use the PERC, and why does it differ from years?
Well, the years score was really just taking a couple of components of the Wells score. And what does it use? It uses Gestalt. It asks about that alternative diagnosis more likely. My favorite thing about the Wells score is to ask doctors to name the alternative diagnosis. And the most common response you'll get is not PE. That's the diagnosis. But what it does is it says that we can use D-dimer at a higher threshold for lower pretest probability patients. That concept has been out for 15 years. I think it's been ready for prime time for a long time. This Menno Huisman went out and did it in a large study and was able to get it published in Lancet. So that's the real difference with the years study compared with about 15 other papers that preceded it.
All right, let's move on, and we're going to ask the clinical question that we're going to try to answer with the paper that we're reviewing today. So what is the clinical question for today's podcast?
Does the PERC rule work in France?
There we go. And that's what we're trying to figure out. Can you apply the PERC rule in France? And so the reference for this was...
This is Jonathan Freund's paper, The Effect of Pulmonary Embolism Rule-Out Criteria on Subsequent Thromboembolic Events Among Low-Risk Emergency Department Patients, The Proper Randomized Clinical Trial, published in JAMA on February 15th, 2018.
So PROPER stands for PERC Rule to Exclude Pulmonary Embolism in the Emergency Department, and it was a crossover, cluster, randomized, clinical, non-inferiority trial conducted in France. Let's frame that with the PICO. So what was the population they were looking at?
Adult patients presenting to the emergency department with low Gestalt clinical probability of pulmonary embolism.
And then they had inclusion and exclusion criteria, and I'll throw those up on the blog in the show notes. What was the intervention?
Either a PERC-based strategy, which was if the patient was PERC negative, they were ruled out. And if they were PERC positive, they went on to further testing. Or usual care without the use of the PERC rule.
And so in comparison, they had usual care. And if you had low gestalt, you got a D-dimer. And if it was positive, you went and got a CTPA. If negative, PE was ruled out. Now, if it was not low gestalt, you went on to get a CTPA. What was their primary outcome?
Occurrence of a symptomatic thromboembolic event within 3 months.
And then they had a number of secondary outcomes, and I'll list those in the show notes. So the author's conclusions were, quote, among very low-risk patients with suspected PE, randomization to a PERC strategy versus conventional strategy did not result in an inferior rate of thromboembolic events over 3 months. These findings support the safety of PERC for very low-risk patients presenting to the emergency department, end of quote. Now, for randomized trials, we have 11 quality checklists that we ask questions to probe the literature for its validity. So we're going to fly through those quickly with a yes, no, or unsure answer. So for the first question, Jeff, are these emergency department patients?
Yes.
Were they adequately randomized?
Yes.
Was it concealed, the randomization?
Well, it couldn't be, because you would know what group you were in, but yes.
Okay. And the patients, were they analyzed in the groups to which they were randomized?
Yes.
Did they recruit patients consecutively so there was no selection bias?
Yes.
Were the patients in both groups similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Yes.
And this is gets to the part about the blinding of the patient. So the randomization question is, did they randomize it? Nobody knew how they were randomizing it, right? And this question is, did the patients, clinicians, and outcome assessors, were they unaware of which group they were randomized to? And that's sort of the no question, right?
Yeah, and it couldn't be because it was block randomized
by
weeks at different sites.
All groups, were they treated equally except for the intervention?
Yes.
And then for follow-up, we like to see at least 80% follow-up. So was follow-up complete?
Yes.
And did they consider all patient important outcomes?
Yes.
And the last question, this is question number 11, the treatment effect, was it large enough, because we're looking for large treatment effects, or precise enough to be clinically relevant?
Well, from a non-inferiority standpoint, yes, but this was not designed to look for actual treatment effect. It was to look at two care processes. So yes and no.
So it was not a superiority trial. It was a non-inferiority trial, and the precision was fairly precise. So let's run through the key results. They recruited close to 2,000 patients, about 950 in each group. The mean age was in the mid-40s, so young, with slightly more women. The diagnosis of PE at the initial emergency department visit was 2.7%. So that rule-in rate, this is a low-risk population, 2.7% in the control group and 1.5% in the PERC group. And that was not a difference. That small difference of a percentage was not statistically different. What was the key result, that take-home one big key primary
there's
outcome?
There's something on my mind I want to do.
Sure, yeah, you
okay,
do it.
One thing I want
Something's
to
on his mind. You got to speak.
You mentioned that the low gestalt group had a prevalence of 2.7%. And that was out of 13 sites in France. And the overall prevalence of PE of all patients worked up was about 20%.
Mm-hmm.
So the gestalt itself had powerful ability to pick a low pretest probability. But the main outcome of this study is who ended up with a recurrence within 3 months. And in the group that was assigned to the PERC group, it was 0.2%. And in the usual care group, it was 0.1%. So extremely close and definitely met the non-inferiority threshold.
Yeah, so the PERC-based strategy was non-inferior to usual care in this study. Now, there's a number of secondary outcomes that I'll list in a table in the show notes so you can go through those secondary outcomes. But did you want to tell us about the one miss that they had? Because they do document one miss, PE, or failure of the PERC rule. And that's quote-unquote failure.
Yeah, this is a patient that was PERC negative, and he was initially discharged and seen again on the next day with ongoing pain. And the second time he showed up, he got a D-dimer that was positive, then got a CTPA. And the first CTPA was interpreted as positive for pneumonia. And he was admitted, had Dopplers done that showed no DVT, then a VQ scan that showed subsegmental defects, which is extremely difficult to see on a VQ scan, but he was treated with oral anticoagulants for 6 months. And I'm gonna say that I would love to see that VQ scan. I'd love to see that CT scan. I'm not sure that patient had any favors done to him, but that was the false negative.
All right, well, is there anything else that you wanna pick out of the results and talk about before we move on to the nerdy section?
Well, I think the most important part is the percentage or the number of subsegmental PEs that were present in the usual care group, which was somewhere around 6, and versus none in the PERC strategy. And so there's six patients that we have to wonder whether they had any favors done to them with usual care. But this study doesn't in any way tell you about the long-term outcome. Maybe the PERC rule failed to find some patients with small filling defects that then 6 months later, they ended up having more severe PEs as a result of not receiving the anticoagulation that they would have with usual care. The other point is that if you look at the absolute reduction in unnecessary CT scanning, these are CT scans that showed no PE and no actionable diagnosis, that magnitude of effect was 8% with the PERC rule. And I would submit if this was an expensive diagnostic test, a machine, a blood test, or an X-ray that had an 8% effect size for reducing CT scan, that it would probably be a $100 million device.
So can you just put it into a little device and sort of they put it into the magic box and it kicks out an answer and you charge a fee for it?
Yeah, I think I'm going to start charging a quarter for every use of the PERC rule and put it in my research fund.
But, all right. No, well, at least you're putting the money to good use.
No, in all seriousness, I do want to say I get asked a lot of times about copyright release for the PERC rule. The PERC rule is free for everybody. You've got it from me, Jeff Klein. You don't have to ask me. If you want me to give you written permission, I will, but you have my permission via this podcast.
Excellent. All right, so this is one of the favorite parts of my podcast, the chance to talk nerdy, and a chance to talk nerdy about PEs with the PE guru. Oh, I'm a fanboy. So let's go through five nerdy questions, and the first one is about low prevalence. These were very low-risk PE patients because only about 2% ruled in the study, only about 2%. So my question to you, Jeff, is wouldn't any strategy look pretty good? Because 98% of the time, if you walked in the room and walked out of the room, you'd be right.
Well, let's go back and recognize that this did show that Gestalt worked in Europe. So there were low risks because of the brains of the physicians who were all strata of experience and age and gender. And just by using your brain and saying, I think that there's less than a 15% chance this patient has PE, chops them down to 3%. It's not that they were drawn from a low-risk population like in the United States. It's that Gestalt works, and Gestalt is part of the PERC rule.
So I'm always telling people that the most important tool that you have is not an app on your phone. It's the app between your two ears, and you've got to go in, use your brain, do a good history followed by a directed physical exam, and then reflect upon what am I going to do now? What's my next step? So I think that's great. Second question is about non-inferiority. This was a non-inferiority design, and one of the threats to the design is the loss to follow-up. And they had 54 patients that were lost to follow-up. And in the worst case scenario that all of them had an event, which seems unreasonable, but in the worst case scenario that they all had an event, would that have that would have breached the upper margin set for the 95% confidence interval of non-inferiority of 1.5%. And I'm looking around the room and realizing I just went full nerd on you, didn't I? I lost some of you. Jeff, can you bring us home on that one maybe?
Well, at least the small possibility that 54 patients were false negatives that were missed. The probability of that is extremely small, but we just don't know. So it always leaves a little bit of doubt.
And you've got to get comfortable with doubt, because if you're practicing emergency medicine, a lot of the times when you're with a patient, the answer is, I'm not sure what it is. And you need to be okay with that, and you need to be able to convince your patients to be okay with that too, because life is not perfect, and life has risks. So be comfortable with the risk. Question number three is about intention to treat and per protocol analysis. They did both forms in this study. Can you comment on the strengths and weaknesses of each type and how we should interpret the results from an intention to treat analysis standpoint and a per protocol standpoint?
Well, intention to treat versus per protocol just means that it's the group that they were initially assigned to. Once randomized, always analyzed is the supposed
term. Oh, I haven't heard that one. Nice.
And so when they went into the intention to treat, they might have migrated over, or they're what they call wild type crossover. In this case, that didn't really change anything for this particular study. It's not quite as important as it is with a drug or device study where somebody might have gotten randomized to placebo and then got the drug for compassionate use or because the doctors thought that the patient got sicker. That happens with lytic trials all the time of pulmonary embolism. So I don't see that as any threat to the validity of this study.
Okay, well, the fourth question comes from the ethos of it all depends. And so when you look at research and you look at the results of research, you've got to reflect back from an evidence-based medicine standpoint. You have the results, you have the literature, but you also have your patient population and their values and expectations and what you bring to the table as a clinician. And so this is about miss rate and what's an acceptable miss rate. Because in America, it seems like you've got a nice round number that everybody's comfortable with as a miss rate. That's zero, by the way, just so you know. And while the failure rate observed in this study after a negative CTPA was about 3%, but you're more likely to get in trouble here, I think, in America, if you didn't do the study and it was a miss, as opposed to the miss rate of 3% and you didn't do the study.
Do you know which culture invented zero or discovered the concept of zero?
I think it was in the Fertile Crescent in the Middle East.
You're correct.
Thank
it
you.
Was not the Greeks. It was not the Latin. The Greeks didn't even have numbers.
No.
So
it was in the Fertile Crescent.
We can thank the Mediterranean for zeros, which we like to have in the United States, but you can never get. So we've asked patients, we've done focus groups, and we've done surveys. The doctors think the number needs to be lower than the patients in the United States. The round number, it seems to be somewhere around 1-2% of what the patients are willing to tolerate. It varies with individual, but across the population, 1% certainly works.
And the final question, question number five, is about clinical decision tools. These tools typically go through a derivation study to figure out which items to include, a validation study, and then few of these studies actually make it to the stage where they do an impact analysis. Do you consider this study that was done in France an impact analysis of the PERC rule, and what other research would you like to see done?
Well, I think this gets into stages of implementation. I'm really interested in all these people I'm meeting around the campus that describe themselves as implementation scientists, and they don't really seem to be doing any actual implementation, but they're implementation scientists. I think that this is the next step to really using the PERC rule and then understanding. And I think it has to be done as part of usual care before we know the impact, and to be able to look at long-term secular trends in CTPA use and what I would call wasted CT rate. So I think this is the step that enables it, makes it happen. So we're ready.
So this is the point in the podcast where I'm going to ask Chris Carpenter, who's my AV tech guy here, to pick up the microphone and ask the audience, do you have any questions for Dr. Klein about PEs? Because I have one that was sent to me earlier, and it says, Jeff, if you have a patient who's postpartum now, how many weeks postpartum can you use the PERC? 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks? And it was a bit of a Twitter poll that went out. And it was a question. I said, well, I'm going to be with Jeff next week at SAM. I'll just ask him.
Yeah, the number I can tell you is 4 weeks.
Okay.
And that's evidence-driven. Is every postpartum woman the same? No. I mean, if she had complications, you might want to go more to 6 weeks. But the number that we've used has been four.
Chris, do you have a question?
So as one of those pseudo-implementation scientists you mentioned, Jeff, I'm wondering what are the challenges that implementation scientists face in getting the PERC rule more widely used in the next 10 years?
I think in the United States, it's going to be the threat or risk of medical malpractice. I think that that would be the feeling that you need to have a test and that that is better than using clinical criteria, even when the numbers are better for the clinical criteria. So it's about culture change, and I think it's normative behavior. It's people learning in their residencies that this is okay to do and then going out and becoming thought leaders in their community groups and saying this is what we should do. You know, the other thing is measuring it. What really changes behavior, especially in large community groups, is if you come in with, say, antibiotic stewardship, you can come in with rules and training, but the thing that really matters is going back and showing people their numbers and how they perform to other people, and especially tying it to their bonus. Holy crap, that will work.
Follow the money?
So it's about like, what do we value as society? If we value not giving radiation exposure to women under age 40 and increasing their risk of breast cancer, we need to measure it and tell our doctors to use the PERC rule to avoid it.
Are there any other questions? And if you want to ask a question, you are going to have to come up to the microphone.
Steve Huff here. I work in a teaching institution. I'm always told all the time, well, this patient's perked out, so we're done. And it's like, well, they're 80, first of all. I don't know that you could perk out. What's the poor practitioner to do about syncope and pulmonary embolism right now? It either happens all the time or it never happens.
Yeah, Dr. Vink is giving a session right now about syncope, and he came up to me and noted that he was going to make the important distinction that I've made on a number of different occasions. There's two types of syncope. There's American syncope, and there's Italian syncope. And Italian syncope is apparently very bad, but it's not so bad in the United States. You saw Dr. Vink's data where he had out of around 20,000 patients with syncope, three of them had pulmonary embolism. If you take the garden variety syncope patient, if they don't have other things that drive your decision making, they don't need to be worked up for PE, end of story. If they flunk PERC, just order a D-dimer. Don't worry about it that much. The D-dimer is going to be negative 55% of the time in syncope patients.
Okay, so we're going to move on now, and this is the time. Get your phone up. This is the time where you're going to comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions.
Okay. The conclusions, we generally agree with the author's conclusions.
That was easy. How about an SGEM bottom line, though? That bottom line to take away from this episode.
Risk stratify your patients and use the PERC rule for those that are not high risk.
And can you give a resolution to the case that we presented?
Well, this patient is Wells criteria non-high and PERC rule negative, and it's time to go talk to the patient and say, I think we can rule out or exclude the possibility of clots in your lungs causing your symptoms.
All right, and then how are you going to take this study, this validation study in France, and apply it clinically with the rest of the literature that's available on the subject?
Well, as we were saying earlier, it's time to start implementing this and measuring it and looking at people's use of it. It validates the PERC rule as a way to decrease the number of unneeded CT scans.
So, Jeff, what are you going to, you know, one of the interesting parts of the podcast is where we look at the literature. This was a randomized non-inferior cluster trial that was done in France. And so how are you going to take this, like, really nerdy information and yet bring it to the patient's bedside so you can explain it to them that they understand what's going on and engage them in some decision making?
Well, the words that I would like to use with this patient is to explain, look, we know you have some chest pain and shortness of breath, and any emergency doctor is going to at least raise the possibility of blood clots in the lung. And there's a couple of ways we could test for that. One of them is using a blood test. Another is doing a special x-ray called a CT scan. The problems with the CT scan include some radiation that we might not have to give to your body and contrast that could stress your kidneys. But fortunately, there's a body of research that lets me use information. This thing's called a prediction rule or decision rule, and it's been done in thousands of patients like you. And this rule, and I tallied it up, this is what they have. See, these are the components. You're negative, which means that you have less than a 1% chance of having clots in your lung. And that's about as good as we can get with any test, either a blood test or an x-ray. So if it's okay with you, I'd like to not do any more testing for clots in the lung. And let's look for some other reasons why you might be having this chest pain and shortness of breath.
It's time for the Keener contest, and there was no winner last week, but the correct answer would have been in Luther Bell's 1849 article on Bell's mania. He gave three possible diagnoses in the differential diagnosis, and that included delirium tremens, meningitis, and advanced typhoid. Yeah. What's the Keener question this week? And this question is a guess what Dr. Klein is thinking.
So I've reviewed over 100 lawsuits alleging negligence because of the failure to diagnose pulmonary embolism in the emergency department. What percentage of the cases involved the failure of a decision rule? Is it 0%, 10%, 50%, or 80%?
So if you know the answer to this question, then send me an email, thesgem@gmail.com, with Keener, or in your case, Gunner, in the subject line, and the first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Well, thanks, Jeff, for coming on and doing this live SGEM episode at SAEM. We haven't even started the maple whiskey yet, you know?
I'm trying to think how to answer with a maple whiskey response. And the thing that immediately came to my mind is I have to go do an NIH session after this.
So no whiskey?
So I think it's
or more whiskey.
Perfect time for some, perfect yeah, time
does that
for
mean
some whiskey.
More or less whiskey? All right. Well, if you've missed, right, because you're watching it on the Facebook stream or listening to the podcast later, if you've missed it, why don't you come to SAEM next year? Where is it?
It is in Las Vegas.
It's in Las Vegas. And hopefully, if you guys like this, and did you like it?
Or did you just like the free lunch?
Then we'll do it again next year. If it gets a good response and stuff, I think it's a great idea, and we'll do it again next year. But the one last thing to do is, Jeff, can you give the SGEM tagline in your best Indiana accent?
Well, that's an accent with no accent. So it's simply, remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Thank you very much. Talk to everybody next time.